Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
It's easy to glorify the concept of our shrinking planet. More connected than ever, the thinking goes, we will understand one another better. In the West, there is a belief that democracy and human rights are being spread through some combination of the internet and capitalism, with a little bit of military thrown in. But the emergence of a single planetary culture has a shadow side as well. I once traveled around the world, crossing Asia, North Africa, and Europe overland. The beauty of such a journey is found partly in its complexity, its variety. That isn't to say that there aren't things one finds in common throughout humanity, but there's a difference between what I might uncover as a universal human quality and the imposition of a global monoculture. All around the world, English is spoken, and it is no coincidence that American dollars are used along with this. As languages die, worldviews die. Unique and beautiful cultures die. There's a parallel between bio and cultural diversity. A healthy ecosystem requires diversity because each species requires other niches to be filled in order to have balance. While we might fear the wolf or be annoyed by the fly, those species benefit the whole and benefit us. Indeed, our collapsing biosphere is largely the result of a loss of biodiversity. Similarly, an individual species requires genetic diversity. When a new disease is introduced, the species has a better chance of surviving if it is genetically diverse. Cultural diversity serves a similar purpose. If the only culture that is valued is that of Western capitalism, how can we find new ways of seeing the world when it becomes apparent, as is surely the case now, that a new worldview is required? Indeed, a large part of our difficulty in seeing beyond market and consumption-based solutions to climate change is the fact that our discourse is so dominated by this single story. Diversity, whether it is of people, cultures, or ideas, is inherently more democratic and less hierarchical, and it can be revolutionary in that it allows for ideas that come from the margins, not just Wall Street or the Ivory Tower, to be heard.
Justin Murphy is a reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle newspaper in Rochester, New York, covering education in the Rochester area with an emphasis on the Rochester City School District. He's worked at the Democrat and Chronicle since 2012, and before that was a reporter for The Citizen in Auburn, New York. He attended the University of Chicago and the S. Hyde Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. "Your children are very greatly in danger. School segregation in Rochester, New York" is his first book. Justin, welcome to the Reimagining Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to talk to you generally about segregation in American public schools, but I thought that we could open by you've done your own background is in Rochester, New York, and you wrote this book about Rochester. So I thought we'd open talking a little bit about Rochester specifically, which happens to be not only where you grew up, but where I did as well. And maybe we could start by just a little bit of background on Rochester. What's it like for a lot of our listeners won't be that familiar with Rochester? A little bit about what makes Rochester both indicative of the broader questions of segregation in our public schools, but also what's maybe a little bit unique about it. So describe maybe briefly for our listeners what Rochester is like as a city.
Sure. Rochester is, we're on Lake Ontario, so we're a fellow Great Lakes city. About 200,000 people live in the city proper and maybe a million in the county around it. So obviously a lot smaller than Chicago. But it's in the broad strokes, it's a standard post-industrial northern, not quite in the Rust Belt, but more or less a Rust Belt city. The same story that you might tell about Buffalo or Cleveland or Gary or Detroit is in broad strokes the story that we have here in Rochester. But what's specific about Rochester is we got a very early and very important boost from Eastman Kodak Company, which is founded and based in Rochester. That and a few other high-tech for the time companies, Xerox, Bosch and Lomb, really floated the local economy for a long time. And then, as we've seen in so many places, that flotation eventually gave way. But having that kind of early, you know, what we'd call now like advanced manufacturing economic base was relevant to the way that the Black community formed and that the story of segregation gets told in Rochester in particular.
There's a history with Eastman Kodak being, while offering a great deal of wealth and support to white people, white families in Rochester, but hasn't, is it fair to say that largely the Black community was excluded from those benefits?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even say largely. I would say just about entirely. There's a really important statewide study in 1939, and that's 7 years after George Eastman dies, and Kodak is still ascending, and they do a survey of the Black population in the upstate New York cities, and they counted out of 16,000 something employees at Kodak, there was one Black person, a porter, out of the entire thing. And George Eastman is on record in private saying that he doesn't really have any interest in hiring Black people, not only at Kodak, but at his height, he's the one who basically creates the University of Rochester, turning it from run-of-the-mill regional college to a powerhouse private university. Same thing for the medical college, which is the hospital. Same thing for the really high-class music school that's associated with it. He pretty much runs the show in the 1910s and 1920s. That, I think, is one important distinction with Rochester, is that, in a city the size of Chicago, there's obviously powerful industrialists, but it's too big for any one person to run the entire show. In Rochester, it was largely run by George Eastman, not to the city's benefit when it comes to equity of opportunity.
Yeah, so that's an interesting distinction. And I think, is it fair to say that another distinction too is that certainly white flight is common in a lot of places, Chicago or other big cities like that, that white flight really in Rochester really isolated and concentrated a lot of poverty within the city limits?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a small enough metropolitan area geographically that you can live in the inner ring suburbs. You can live in the outer ring suburbs and be downtown in 25 minutes. So white flight hit pretty hard. And I think, well, the whole trajectory of the Great Migration of Black people into Rochester came later, and then white flight was very impactful in the 70s and 80s in particular.
Yeah, it was primarily a post-World War II migration, whereas in other cities like Chicago, it started really after World War I. Is that true with the Great Migration?
Yeah, and that gets back to what we were talking about with George Eastman. If you figure the main goal for the migrants is to go up north and get one of these wartime factory jobs, there were just none to be had in Rochester. So instead, what we get here is people come to the agricultural areas kind of around the county and are doing migrant stoop labor. And then eventually, starting in about 1950 is when it starts to take off. But even as late as 1950, the Black population in Rochester is 2%, which is, I think, very distinct from a place like Chicago, of course.
Yeah, sure. Right. I sort of like to talk a little more broadly about segregation. And I really want to context for the concept of segregation, particularly in schools, because I think when you talk about segregation, we're not just sort of talking about this notion that people might choose to live in different areas. We're really talking about systemic and historical ways in which resources or access or equality are denied to certain groups of people, right? I think that maybe we could start by talking about the way that Black Americans, going all the way back to slavery, have been denied access to education. And then also with Jim Crow, we had segregation that was legal and you couldn't go to certain schools if you were Black, right? That's kind of like the basic context. I mean, would you say, as someone who's researched this a lot, like how much would you say that for you, is there like a common thread that goes all the way back to slavery, really, in terms of denying access to equal education? Do you feel like there has been, do you feel like that legacy has really ever been dealt with properly in the United States?
No, it certainly hasn't. And, you go through phases. So like in New York, slavery was finally abolished at the very end of it in 1827. But then there's a pretty long period in some cities, up to 50 years, where there's still separate Black schools. And it's like a very prolonged, I guess, acclimatization period on behalf of white people in terms of what they will put up with in terms of proximity to Black people. And, I guess that would be one thing if, like, at the end of that period, everything was okay. But, you know, instead, what we see repeatedly in every single context, including education, is that during that interim period, these barriers get put up and these systems get put up that end up having an enormous effect. So in the context of education, the fact that schools are generally funded by local property taxes, which on its face is not a racially explicitly discriminatory thing, but ends up having just enormous consequences as, you know, later on, a century later, whatever, we get into the white flight that you're talking about. And, you know, it's not even so much the individual friendly white neighbors who are leaving the city, but these huge, huge amounts of property tax revenues that fund education and so many other things.
Right. We were talking a little about housing too. And I think that talk a little bit maybe about redlining and the impact that that has on de facto segregation, because I think a lot of these issues are interrelated, right? That we can't, it's not only, and sometimes that's what challenges school districts to deal with these questions, because they're dealing with only kind of sometimes the result of a broader thing. And like, so say a little about kind of how redlining and housing discrimination plays a role in it.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing that I learned as I was researching this book is that in Rochester, as I think in a lot of other cities, when you go into the 19th century, before the Great Migration begins, whenever it begins in a given community, the housing discrimination is not as rigid as it later becomes. The numbers in the Black community are very small, and there's, you know, various technological and city-making differences, such that while it's true that most of the Black community might live in a given neighborhood, there still can be others living elsewhere. And even in that one neighborhood, it's not entirely Black. It's still probably predominantly non-Black people. But as the migration comes in, like, those sort of loose patterns just get calcified enormously. And redlining, you know, as a catch-all term, that sort of refers to all the schemes that the white power structure enacts to keep the Black, growing Black population in its place. So that's redlining in particular, which is both a reflection of the existing boundaries and of course, a hardening of them as well. You've got racially restrictive covenants, which are enormously important. You've got the real estate code of ethics. And then on top of all that, of course, is just regular old violence from people who don't want Black people living near them. So that all combines to, as I said, redlining is sort of, I think, a useful catch-all term to point to that. But I think it's also important to recognize that it's like a huge web of interrelated prejudices and systems that have the ultimate effect of preventing Black people from not only living where they want to live, but maybe more importantly, building any wealth to pass down to their kids.
Right. And so part of that is that in the situation we look at now, you have essentially like a generations of families whose wealth has been stolen from them through variety of processes such as slavery and the denial of the ability to own a home and things like that. And that presents obstacle to integrating schools, I think, because what you have in many areas is you have wealth in the hands of more white people, and then you have a lot more poverty concentrated in other areas, and that presents an obstacle. I want to talk a little bit about some of the other obstacles to desegregating schools. I know that in the example of Rochester, New York, that you talk about, there's this question of whether or not the school district should be, the entire metropolitan area should be a single district and integrated, because there's so much poverty concentrated within the city itself. That's been really difficult politically, though. Talk a little bit about that. Like, what are the challenges to combining, say, the city of Rochester with some of the suburban areas?
Yeah. I mean, every single state and municipality has its own specific challenges. So in New York, by kind of a historical accident, most of the school districts across the state don't match up with any other particular municipal boundaries. So like the town of Brighton does not at all follow the same lines as the Brighton Central School District for a variety of reasons, except in the case of, call it the Big Five, the five major cities in New York, which New York City, Yonkers, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse. It's written in state law that the school district lines will be precisely coterminous with the municipal lines. And then those are funded separately. So since it's, you know, at this point in history, not a fair expectation that those cities can support the education system and everything else through their property taxes. The big cities in Rochester get funded mostly through the state for their education budgets. And that has caused all kinds of problems and has been a point of contention for over 100 years that if only we could break that rule and give the urban school districts maybe a little bit of flexibility or a greater opportunity to work with the metropolitan districts, or I'm sorry, with the nearby suburban districts, that could open a lot of doors. It wouldn't necessarily lead to anything automatically, but so like the point you're talking about, a metropolitan school district like exists in some other places in the country, is off the table until that law gets addressed one way or the other.
I see. And there's also, I mean, and there's for sure, in the case of a smaller city like Rochester, there's resistance to integrating. There's resistance to integrating. There are people who say, who want to sort of protect their district. You have the same issue going on in a big city like Chicago, where you have this happening within the district itself, where there's resistance on the part of some, whenever there's a question of changing where the district lines are or moving kids from one part of the city to the other. It's a similar kind of response that you might get. There's kind of the stereotype we have. I mean, you talk in the book about the violence that happened, I think it was in the early 70s when people were busing kids and that kind of thing. And you saw that in a lot of different districts around the country during that period of time when schools, particularly in northern urban districts, were desegregating. And there's kind of a stereotype of like working class white people resisting that and doing it violently, right? But there's also, I think, a thing that happens in places that are perceived to be more liberal. And there are people who are, and I can speak to, certainly this happens in more liberal areas here in Chicago and in Rochester and areas that Rochester sort of thinks of itself as a progressive liberal city. But I think that there is, I think, a resistance among people there's a limit to that liberalism, right? Isn't there like sort of like an unwillingness to send their kids, like people will be liberal and vote for Democrats, but sending their kids to a school mostly with Black children is something that a lot of white people are really resistant to and fearful of. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's true. So like in the 70s, in the late 60s, when Rochester and other places are having this like very loud dispute over desegregation, it is mostly the, you know, what they used to call back then the ethnics who are on the front lines, so to speak, you know, because they're kind of the last ones on the totem pole, except for Black people, and they find themselves threatened. And also they're the ones living in the neighborhoods proximate to, you know, what are rapidly turning into Black ghettos in Rochester and other cities. You see, I think, in kind of outlying wealthier areas, they're not usually the ones with the bricks and the bats and that kind of thing. But that might be in large part because they have access to a broader array of tools to kind of get what they want and move the political processes. And then at this point, it's true that most avowedly progressive people don't want to send their kids into mostly Black schools. And Rochester is different from, like you mentioned, in Chicago or New York, where there's these pockets of comparatively privileged white schools within CPS or something. In Rochester, I think the school in the city school district with the most white kids is maybe like 30% white. So that same thing doesn't really exist. And it's been reinforced so much by the district lines that, you know, not only are their kids not in those schools where they might help put pressure on the principal or whatever it is that, however it is that people wield influence on a day-to-day basis, but they're actually not only in politically separate entities, but are physically segregated, like literally physically in a different place, and don't see people who aren't like them. And, you know, that of course has like enormous consequences just in terms of how any individual child grows up seeing the world, and that perpetuates the whole problem.
Sure. Yeah. What would you say about this moment? And I think over the last couple of decades, there's been, as I see it, less emphasis on integration as this so-called school reform movement has kind of picked up. And I'm thinking of the rise of charter schools and a lot of the focus on bringing up test scores specifically. These, you know, neoliberal models for education have kind of de-emphasized the kind of older kind of liberal notions of integration as a value. Is it fair to say that to a large extent, like some of these school districts at least have largely given up on pushing for greater integration in their schools?
I'd say that almost every single school district in the country has done that, except where it's already has mechanisms in place. I mean, when you look in the civil rights era, there's a pretty wide consensus that whatever it is that we do to address the problems of academic access or performance for non-white students, it's going to have to include some integration component. You know, and obviously we'll work on the pedagogy and the curriculum and whatnot, but even comparatively reactionary factions of the community would agree that you need to do something around that. Since that failed, essentially, in most parts of the country, either right away in the 60s and 70s or later as federal orders went away later on, that whole half of the conversation have disappeared. And so now that there's no way to address the question or even ask the question in a broader sense. It's only like we take it as a given that the schoolhouse is going to be segregated. That's just how it is. So what can we do? And so you can give them more money, you can take away their money, you can give them a state monitor or something like that. You can provide choice, you know, within the same segregated context, which is charter schools or vouchers or something like that. And, you know, those all, like, you can debate any of those ideas on their merit. And some of them work, some of them don't to some extent. The main thing that I keep returning to in the book is that that all flies directly in the face of this Supreme Court case that we're all so proud of that says that that's absolutely not a constitutional or morally appropriate way to educate children. And it doesn't matter if the teachers are equally trained and the school buildings are equally renovated. The mere fact of having these essentially separate systems of education is wrong. But like later Supreme Court precedent has essentially cut down on all the ways that you could address that. And so here we are sort of stuck in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and even if it, and the notion that in any way, it's really a little disingenuous, I think, to suggest that in any way we can have separate but equal schools. If we look at how resources end up being spent, if we look at so many different factors that come into play that affect how our schools are structured, it's not at all. And that's what the original court case essentially said, and we seem to ignore it now, that it really isn't possible, particularly given all the broader historical context of our country that we've been talking about a little bit. It's really not in any way imaginable that we could have anything close to equal schools with that level of segregation.
So in Rochester, there's a good example that I think is universally applicable. There's this one high school, East High School, which about a decade ago was, you know, floundering in the way that urban schools do. Graduation rates 40% or whatever. So the state comes in and says essentially you have to shut it down or take one of these drastic steps. And so they cooked up a partnership with the University of Rochester. So the university is going to bring all of its academic resources to bear. The state's putting in a bunch of money. So they've got an absolutely enviable amount of funding and this wonderful curriculum and the structures and everything that you could ask for. Graduation rate's gone up, retention rate's gone down, like everything, you know. So, okay, great, that's working. This fall, when all the kids came back from COVID, we saw across the country that schools were having a hard time with, as kids come back and they didn't have the, you know, emotional supports, whatever, as kids face trauma while they're out of school, they come in and there's violence, there's fighting, whatever. And East, like other schools in the city, gets just crushed by that. It was extremely disruptive. And to me, that points to the limit of these neoliberal school reform models, because that's not something that the school can do. And like, you know, COVID hopefully is not something that keeps recurring, but, you know, there's plenty of one-off disruptions of that sort. And inevitably, they will have a disproportionate impact on schools that are segregated, regardless of what fancy charter school model or governance structure or whatever they happen to have in place.
Yeah, I love that example, both because it demonstrates exactly what we're talking about, but also because East High is my own alma mater. And so we're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back. And I'd like to jump into exploring what some of the problems with segregation in our schools are. Reimagining is a place for people who believe that the stories of the modern world no longer sustain us, bringing us to the brink of catastrophe, ecologically, economically, spiritually. Our troubles cannot be solved merely through technology or even politics. Rather, we need to reimagine what it means to be human. We seek new stories, new poetics, new ideas, and we put our ideas and stories into action. This work requires the wisdom of those at the margins and by those with the courage to imagine a new world. I'm talking with Justin Murphy today, and his book, Your Children Are Very Greatly in Danger, explores school segregation in Rochester, New York. So we've been talking about kind of the history of segregation, both in Rochester, but more broadly in the United States. And we mentioned a little bit about what some of the specific example of kind of some of the problems that can be caused by segregation. Could you talk a little bit more about what you see to be some of the problems with segregation in schools in terms of the both in the classroom itself, perhaps, like from a in terms of an individual's education, but also more broadly about how it might affect how and where resources go?
Well, let me start by talking about my the title of my book, Your Children Are Very Greatly in Danger. It comes from a James Baldwin essay, and maybe contrary to a person's expectation, he's addressing the you in that is not Black families, but white families. And what he says is, I know you didn't do it, and I didn't do it either, but I am responsible for it because I am a man and a citizen of this country, and you are responsible for it too, for the very same reason. As long as my children face the future they face and come to the ruin that they come to, your children are very greatly endangered too. They are endangered above all by the moral apathy, which pretends it isn't happening. This does something terrible to us. And I think another consequence of the school reform era, as I call it in the book, is this like hyper focus on accountability and measurement and desegregating data and things like that. And that has been useful in a lot of senses, but has also, I think, given us a false idea that the value of education or the worth of any particular education is ultimately quantifiable. And I think that any educator worth their salt could tell you that that's not the case for any number of reasons. And I think when we think of it in that way, like I'm going to go to this school instead of that school because it's 2.6 points higher on whatever ranking it is, it becomes easy to lose sight of all that other stuff that education is supposed to do, like more broadly preparing you to live in the world, you know, exercise your civic duties and that sort of thing. And as that goes unmeasured, I think that it's easy for us to overlook the harm that segregation and, you know, inequality more generally do to kids that go to those schools, to families that live in those communities, to, you know, the whole society as it exists in that state.
There's a lot to unpack there. So let's try to take a few steps here. So I love that you included James Baldwin's quote in the title of your book. One of the things that Baldwin is so good at is recognizing the kind of entanglement and interrelatedness of Black and white in this country and how the white identity relies upon and is ultimately diminished by the construction of race in this country and in these power relationships. And the experience of oneself as white, as an oppressor, also diminishes the people who are doing the oppression as well. And I think that he really speaks really profoundly to that. And I think that it speaks to some of the things that are lost in the process of reducing education in this. I think you really hit it right on the head talking about your critique of the school reform movement and these kind of neoliberal focuses on quantification and on really individual achievement above all else. Because one of the purposes, yeah, I think, of public education, rather than just being about individual achievement and individual success as defined by a capitalist system, also ought to be one's ability to participate in a democracy. And I think that losing that sense of responsibility for each other and responsibility for a whole community, that's one of the big things that's been lost in some of those movements, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that quantification continues throughout your life. And so it's easy for a person to say, well, like, yeah, that sounds all well and good, but I graduated and I went to college and now I make $80,000 a year and have my little house and my family and whatever. And like, it remains hard to see the damage that's done until you kind of think more broadly, like, if education is supposed to be the building block of our society and we look and see these terrible outcomes throughout our society in terms of mental health problems, in terms of drug addiction, in terms of early death rates, like all of this just stuff indicating despair throughout our community. Fine, everybody learned algebra in their suburban high schools. To the extent that something is missing in American society, to the extent that it sometimes feels like things are just like rotting from the inside, surely education ought to play a part in that, for better or for worse.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely true. I think that in a lot of ways, I think we all lose out when we have more segregated schools. A lot of the learning, and you might even argue that most of the learning one does. I would say that's true from my own experience in, certainly in high school, I would say this is true, that a lot of the most profound lessons I learned had very little to do with the actual curriculum, but they had to do with the people that I met and the interactions I had as particularly as an adolescent, when like your kind of social life and meeting people and expanding your sense of who you are and expanding your world is really fundamental to your development as a human being. And I think the more that experience can involve different perspectives, the more in a holistic sense, the better educated a person will be and the better prepared a person will be to move in the world and be able to impact the world more positively.
Yeah. And I mean, we sound like a bunch of squishy headed liberals saying that, but that's the nature of the value that a person has in their life, is the way that they're able to do those things. So I grew up in the suburbs of Rochester. I went to a school that was almost entirely white and middle class and higher. And, you know, people ask me sometimes, like, if I learned any of this stuff in school. And I say, no, I don't think I did. You know, not that any of us necessarily remember all of the curriculum in our high school classes or whatever. But I think more to the point, even if I did have a progressive teacher who taught me about some of this stuff, it's hard to assimilate it into your worldview as a kid living in an all-white town with all-white friends in an all-white school. For me personally, it wasn't until I ended up going to school in Chicago, and then when I moved back to Rochester and started working as a journalist in the city, that I was able to drop some of this stuff into place. Like, oh, now I understand what that meant, or like, now I can see the other side of my experience. You know, before that, like, whether I happened to read it in a book or not, I didn't have any way to assimilate it.
Yeah, it's really interesting having this conversation with you, because I mentioned earlier that the school you gave as an example of a school that was at one point failing and the state took it over was East High School in Rochester, where I went to school. And the experience I had growing up was going to that school. I was able to meet people from so many different backgrounds from all over the world, really. And having that experience that really opened me up to different ways of seeing the world and different perspectives and different experiences that were so different from the experience I had had and in my neighborhood elementary school that I had gone to as well, it profoundly affected me and really helped shape the person that I would become as I grew and into adulthood, you know. And
yet, if your parents had gone and looked at the school rankings or whatever, East High School would have been ranked poorly. I mean, it was not a well-regarded school.
And I don't mean to diminish the genuine issues that the school had. And for people who perhaps had less parental support and other things in their life, those issues would have affected them maybe even more profoundly, right?
Yeah.
And there are also ways in which that schools can be internally segregated as well, and that certain students within schools get more access to certain services and things like that. So there's that, all of those things are very real issues. But there's a real benefit, though, just generally to being around different kinds of people and learning from that. And that always, I think, always has stayed with me. So, you know, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about some solutions, right? And you've talked, you know, in your book, you talk a little about specifically in Rochester, some suggested kind of next steps. So I wanted to talk to you about as much as you can, make some generalizations. What do you see as someone who's really researched this a great deal and understands all the different economic and political factors at play and cultural factors as well? Like, what are your recommendations for how we can address this huge issue of segregation in American public schools?
Yeah, so I have three recommendations in my book, of which two are more or less Rochester specific, but I'll try to generalize. The first one, I would say, generally speaking, is that you need to gather the facts about the obstacles to whatever more integrated system you imagine. So like in New York, that's probably a metropolitan school system, or at least some kind of metropolitan cooperation. And there are very specific obstacles to that. I mentioned before the way that the district lines are drawn. Another one is that there's no real way to direct funding to something other than a traditional looking school district. And, you know, for decades, people have come up with these visions of what a better school or school system could look like and have immediately been shot down because they can't answer these very basic questions like where does the money come from and who runs it and, you know, how long are the kids on the bus and that kind of thing. So I would say that any community needs to have those facts at hand, and that probably involves a study of some kind, which is not a sexy recommendation, but you can't talk about it until you can answer the basic questions. So that's number one. Number two, we here in Rochester, we happen to have a program on the books that has the authority to move kids back and forth across school district boundaries. It's one of these programs where kids from the city can apply to attend suburban schools. And it's run in Rochester in a very inequitable way. The suburban districts pick the kids like, NFL draft as opposed to a lottery system. And so I recommend a series of changes to the way that that's run. And more generally, I would say that any community, like even before you get to that promised land goal that we talked about in the first step, think about the ways that the rules on the books can be used to provide a more equitable rule or system. So that might be changing the placement policies in some way, or, you know, like you mentioned, internal segregation within schools. That's a huge deal. That's something that's like educators absolutely have the tools to address once they dedicate themselves to it. That kind of stuff is like, in the meantime, steps that can be taken. There's something that you can do in any system. And then the third thing, and I think this is a universal one, like the obstacle to those first two is political pressure from white parents, or like, put it briefly, racism. Like, people will push back on whatever steps toward equity or integration you might take. And that's largely because this history, like what I've gathered for Rochester, and people have done incredible work in Chicago and other places as well, people don't understand how our current system came to be. It wasn't just like the natural progression of things that all the black people, you know, they liked it in the city. So like, of course, they're living in those neighborhoods and they could have left and gone to Schaumburg or whatever, but they didn't. I think that by learning about that, by spreading that knowledge, by getting people to think directly about, you know, the harms that we've been talking about here, that's the only way that you ultimately break down this opposition. Because like, there are a lot of black people walking around Rochester and Chicago who got hit in the head with rocks during the desegregation struggle in the 60s and 70s. And they're absolutely right today to say that that doesn't sound like a good idea, because we tried it once and it was real violent because the white people pushed back against it so hard. So if we, you know, as white people consider ourselves evolved from, you know, when our grandparents did that, then we have to demonstrate that through learning about it, through processing it, and through identifying ways that we can act differently today. And, you know, that's not a thing for today and tomorrow that's going to make a change. But, you know, ultimately, that's why we send our kids to school. And that's why we say that education is as important as we say it is, because we're trying to help raise kids into adults that will take the society into a better place in whatever sense that means. And certainly integration is one of those higher goals.
Justin Murphy, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
My pleasure.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.